Father! The call drifted down the riverbank. The seated priest, fishing pole in hand, turned at the sound and looked over his left shoulder. Between the trees, he could see the novice, Elred, standing waving at him. Elred. Without changing expression, the priest beckoned the novice to come down to him, and Elred did, crackling branches hanging onto limbs and stumbling over stones, and with a clatter of rocks, he finally came to a stop beside him on the edge of the water, breathing slightly heavily. Hello, Father. I hoped I would find you here. And it would seem that you have, Elred. Hello. What can I do for you? The priest looked back at the place where the thin linen line disappeared into the water. He began to gather it in, winding the line around the reel. Father, I believe that... Well, I have something to ask you. I believe that I have been a novice for a long time. Most novices are received into the Brotherhood after a year, but I've been a novice for over two now. I'd like to be a monk. That's why I came here, to become a monk. I do the work. I'm assigned. I clean. I work in the fields. I help prepare supper. I attend Mass and pray the little hours, all of them. I do everything I'm asked. Why have other novices who have entered the novitiate after me become monks before me? The baited hook came up out of the water. The priest unwound the line from the reel, laying it carefully in large loops at his feet. Then with a sideways flip, tossed the hook back upstream, where it landed with a soft plop, the ripples quickly vanishing in the slow current. And he watched as the line drifted downstream toward a log. "You're my father, confessor," Elred said, "and I would like very much if you could help me understand." "Elred," the priest began, "do you remember why you came to the abbey?" "Well, yes, of course," Elred replied, the rocks shifting under his feet. He put out a hand to steady himself. "I wanted something better. I didn't want to take over my father's carpentry business or my uncle's tanning business. I was restless at home and needed to get out, to go and do something for God, to choose to serve him in the best way I could, and becoming a monk and praying and helping is the best way I know." "Yes, that is what you said then, and it is what you say now. It would seem that that is the reason you came to us. That is also the reason you are still a novice." "I don't understand." The priest nodded slightly and then began gathering in his line again, winding it round and round the reel on his rod. When the hook had left the water, dripping little circles under the water that collided and cross-hatched the surface before running away, he lay the rod on the ground and turned to the novice. Not understanding is a problem seen throughout the Bible. It is also a problem that we all encounter and must learn to correct. There is only one way to do that. He paused. "What is it, Father?" Elred asked. "When Elijah drank from the brook, his drink was far different from the drink that Jezebel had from her well. Both drank because they were thirsty, both drank water, but still the drinks were very different. Would you like to see why?" The novice nodded. "Yes, I would." "Very well. Kneel and take a drink from the river." Elred knelt gingerly among the rocks, placed his hands in the water, and bent to drink. The priest then slid off his rock, knelt beside Elred, placed both hands on the back of his head, and pushed him under the water. For a second, Elred did not react. Then he began to push back upwards. The priest pushed harder, holding Elred's face under the water's surface. Elred tried to push back, and then to pull back, to gather his knees under him, his whole body tensed and writhed, trying to pull back out of the water to stand up. But the priest pushed down with more of his weight. Elred tried to grab the priest's hand with one of his own, his elbow on the rocks, his hand searching, grabbing desperately, his feet and knees pushing and scraping. And finally the priest let go. Elred's face shot up out of the water as he rocked back onto his heels and knees, gasping, spluttering, streaming, and dripping. He bent, hands on his knees, gasping for several seconds, then straightened, wiped his face and eyes, and looked at the priest in puzzlement. "The difference between Jezebel and Elijah is that Elijah knew where his drink came from and was grateful for it, Jezebel didn't care, and so didn't know, and wasn't grateful. That's why she was evil. Ingratitude does that. Usually it does it in very small ways, a refusal here, a rebellion there, a little one. But it is evil in ways very real nonetheless. Many of the ways of ingratitude are subtle, but very strong. The priest put one hand on the novice's shoulder. Elred, just then, what did you want more than anything in the world? I wanted to breathe, Father. I wanted air. Yes. Now go back to the abbey and learn that you will become a monk when you have learned to want God just as you wanted that air. Christian, what do you really want? The question is not as easy to answer as you may think, because we shroud our wants with a cloud of reasons and excuses until many times we really do not know what we want. Now, we still want it, whatever it is. We just don't know why, and therefore we don't know if we should want it, because not everything we want is good for us. But if we don't know why we want it, we won't know what to do about it, and we won't even know if it is good for us. But the desires we have that are not good will persist until we damage ourselves and others unless we learn about them and deal with them, which means dealing with ourselves, and we can do that only if we stop avoiding asking the hard questions and facing the hard facts. A saying in some parts of psychology is, what we resist persists. If we resist facing a fear, that fear will drive us to do what we should not. If we resist finding out why we are angry about something, we will continue to be angry about it, even if we shouldn't be. What we resist persists. If you feel hurt or insecure in a relationship, say, you could open yourself to the feelings you have and face them honestly and understand them, and then know what to do. Or you could resist them and say, I shouldn't be feeling that, or I don't feel that, or it's your fault that I feel that, or let's watch a movie, or go to a bar, or go to Disneyland, or move to Terre Haute, or find another boyfriend or girlfriend so I don't feel that. And if we do that, that hurt or that insecurity is controlling us and shaping our every experience, even determining how we see each other. I'm scared, you're bad, is sadly common among us, because we're not being honest with ourselves and therefore with each other. If we're not honest with ourselves, we can't be honest with each other. Instead, we will interpret an experience. We will judge it, usually badly, because our motives tend to be self-centered, and then we will apply a self-centered remedy. We'll numb it, we'll push it away, we'll control it, we'll do anything but face it. You see, if we face it and realize that we must change, our sense of self, our self-concept, really is organized and centered around the unconscious belief that my mind should not have what I do not like, not even if it's inside me. And that's a big reason so many people do not want to be Christians, because to be a Christian means to follow the God who is telling us that we are sinners and must change. No, we reply silently, and sometimes not even to ourselves, anything but change, because this proclamation that we are sinners leaves us no place to hide and every need to change, and I do not know what that means. And so, my self-concept disappears. I don't know who I am now. I don't really know myself. I have no defenses. I cannot control even my inner world. My familiar sense of ego no longer exists, and I cannot know what it is that I will become because God hasn't told me yet. I must have faith, but I am too scared to have faith. So I fear what God demands of me, and fear almost always comes out as anger, which is why so many people react to the gospel with anger, or with refusal, or with a feeling of superiority. It's why so many people in the Bible reacted to the prophets with anger. It's why we do too, when God gives one among us as a prophet for another. Check the prophets. Most of the time they didn't say, this is what will happen. Most of the time they said, this is what you're doing wrong. Stop it and return to God. That's what people hated them for. And guess what? We still do. We frequently anger at those who tell us what we do not want to hear, even if it's true. Which is why we resort to rhetorical tricks in order to distract ourselves and them. Oh yeah, well, you're not so great yourself, is a common way of responding, which changes the subject and does not address it, doesn't deal with the thing. It's a cheat, but we do it. You see, just because they said it, just because I don't like it, doesn't mean that it isn't true, and it doesn't mean that they shouldn't say it. It simply means that we need to accustom ourselves to hearing hard truths without recoiling or blaming. And the way to do that is to fulfill the apostolic commands to confess our sins. Confess your sins to each other and pray for each other. Both James and John say that. Which is what Nehemiah leads the people of Israel to do here in Nehemiah 9. Now, chapters 9 and 10 are really one document, actually. One passage, because chapter 9 is a great confession and chapter 10 is a series of pledges that are caused by that great confession. Now, going back a bit, we've seen that when Israel heard again the law of God, people began to mourn, but Nehemiah said, whoa, no, nope, stop, not yet. Wait a minute. There's a way that we must do this. And led them instead into a celebration. God gave us his word. He gave us what is right. Let us celebrate and thank God for it, is what he said. Holiness and love, holiness and laughter are natural companions, for how else should we react than by rejoicing in God's love? A good way to practice that is to practice being willing to accept love from others when it is given, something we often refuse to do. And thereby we learn not to recognize God's love, because the two look very much the same. And so we refuse it as well. But Israel learned to rejoice in God's law. You know, they still do that today. The last day of the Jewish year is called Simchat Torah, or joy in the Torah. And they get out, and the Orthodox hold they take the Torah scroll. I think it's the only time in the whole year the Torah scroll leaves the synagogue. And they take it out into the street, and they dance with it, and they dance around it, and they thank God for his law. That's what they did essentially in Nehemiah 8. Israel rejoiced in God's law. And then after they had a time partying, they remembered his provision for them in another hard time, and they had the time of Sukkoth. And now they come to this act of worship. After the reading of the law, after the week of Sukkoth, and then after another day, they hold a 6-hour service of confession. Now, notice something unlike so much of American Christian church services, where we must be excited and happy with concert, stage, lights, and productions. But instead, Israel had a time of feasting and then a time of fasting. And there was time in between the two, so those who stayed on for the fast did so deliberately. Laughter is part of holiness. Joy is an inevitable result of obedience, but this laughter and joy is not ours, and we will only truly live it as we truly understand it, and we truly understand it as we understand our own sinfulness. We have to face the hard questions. Not just our sins now. Heavens, we Christians can misuse God's grace to receive forgiveness and not think about it, and therefore not to be grateful for it, to receive it with that worst of all attitudes, ingratitude, and thus live as those who have not been forgiven, because what happens then is that we do not apply it, which means we've never really received it, even though we've talked about it. We've only received it self-centeredly. Now, the only way to truly live God's love and grace and joy is to remember our own sinfulness, and that takes honesty and confession. It's not enough to know that you are a sinner, because knowing without confessing is hiding, which is lying. I know I'm a sinner, but I'm not going to tell you about it. Means I'm not going to really live the truth that I say that I know, which means that I don't know it at all. And that kind of false witness is a sin that needs confessing itself. It also shows that God is not really our God, but rather when we do that, someone else's opinion is our God, and that idolatry is subtle and deep because it is socially acceptable. Its price is hypocrisy and dissatisfaction and restlessness, and since what we resist persists, it becomes our life, and we can hide it only so long before someone finds out about it because we will not change it, and then of course we blame them. And so what Nehemiah says is we must confess, which trains us in honesty about what is real. It makes us real. And by it, we become obedient and free and strong and joyful. Now, at this point in Israel's history, Nehemiah knows well that the 7-day feast must leave behind it something more than just a taste for fun and camping and food. The desire to be obedient must be harnessed to obedience itself. Otherwise, it becomes a mere velleity. There's your vocabulary word for the week. A velleity is a wish that is so weak it results in no action. Gee, I wish I could, or I wish I were, and do nothing about it, that's a velleity, and it really doesn't matter. It doesn't mean anything. As intentions don't, our acts do, however. And so the people drew apart at first, which would have been something of a sacrifice when you think about it, because their Gentile neighbors would generally have been better off than they were. Where were they living? They'd left everything behind. They had just what they could take with them. So they went in a covered wagon out here to the west, basically southwest, and came back home. They went to Jerusalem, and what they brought with us is all that they had. Their neighbors, the Gentile neighbors, however, had been living there, and so they had much more than they did. Plus, there were some social connections they would have needed. But instead, they forsook those, and they drew apart, and they made that sacrifice because they needed to remember their God above all, and they needed to want him as they want air. So they again bring out the book of the law, and they read it for 3 hours. It's there in verse 3. Then, after that, they pray and confess for 3 more hours. So their confession was something longer than what we see here. What Nehemiah has written down is the essence, no doubt, a summary of their confessions. But it doesn't take 3 hours to read this. So there was much more going on in this service than what we read. Surrounded as they are by enemies and poverty and rubble, they gather as one to join themselves to their God, who is higher than their circumstances. Then after hearing, they stand up to pray, and what a prayer it is. They start with God from verse 5 to 9. They talk about God, which is the way worship always begins or should begin. Worship is about God and to God. But then you'll notice, after verse 9, you alternates with they. They did. You did. Sin abounds. Grace more abounds. We really only know ourselves measured against God. But we can really only know what we are to become when we measure ourselves against God. Humbling, and then hope, is the confession of Israel and the life of the people of God. Now notice what causes, as they speak, this is especially in verses 9 through 15, notice what causes the people to fall again and again. In verse 16, Israel is freed, and then what does it do? Of course, we remember the story. They wanted to go back to Egypt, didn't they? God feeds them and gives them water, and they grumble. They lack absolutely nothing, it says in verse 21. And they appreciated nothing in verse 17. Over and over again, in the face of every gift of God, they refused to be grateful and they would not change. They resisted change, so they persisted in their sin.